On this podcast, we explore fantastical thinking, moral panics, urban legends, conspiracy theories, hoaxes, and crazes, examine the forces that shape our culture, and tell the stories that create the realities we share, and sometimes the realities we don't. I'm your host, Chelsea Weber Smith, and this is American Hysteria.
A nude horse is a rude horse.
It was the plastic-wrapped 1950s, and the squeaky clean, syrupy sweet, holy American nuclear family morality was clipping the frigid suburban dream to perfection, like a sculpted emerald hedge. Espousing the strict values of patriotism, consumerism, Christianity, democracy, and opportunity, the culture was also cut through with an extreme distaste for any expression of sexuality. It was a time of the mass censorship of books, comics, TV shows, movies, of any entertainment or entertainer deemed indecent. But one group was willing to take this pearl clutching to an extreme that made even the staunchest moral crusaders lower their sin-slashing swords and shrug.
It's kind of like someone who drops a match and suddenly you have a forest fire. But in a sense, that's what I did by lighting a match underneath the idea that all animals should wear clothing for the sake of decency, namely horses, cows, dogs, cats, any animal that stands higher than 4 inches or as long as...
A long unaddressed issue of ancient cultural rot was finally coming into the light, and someone was finally taking action against the natural smut that lived all around us, eating our grass, fetching our sticks, galloping through our fields. The Society for Indecency to Naked Animals, or CINNA, was fighting to spread awareness and to pass federal laws, all in the hopes that, like humans, animals would eventually be required to wear clothing that covered their unmentionables. CINNA's president was a man named G. Clifford Prout Jr., a clean-cut, thickly bespectacled activist, eyebrows constantly furrowed over the pet perversion that no one else seemed radically decent enough to face head on.
Disgusting. That's what he calls it. Animals parading themselves without clothes. He is Mr. Clifford Prout, president of an American society which aims to protect us all from the sight of naked animals. Any animal, from the elephant to the mouse, should be decently attired. To protect our feelings, many dogs are already following Mr. Prout's precepts, but some are naturally beyond reproach. The Society has a membership of 50,000, presumably sincere supporters, of a view of life which finds depravity in a puppy dog. Clothe him, says Mr. Prout. Make him decent.
It was on NBC's Today Show that Prout had his first public appearance on May 27, 1959, and the major ratings boost that such a bizarre campaign produced led to guest spots on more and more radio news and talk shows, and with each new interview, he would admonish Americans with his patented catchphrase.
A nude horse is a rude horse.
He announced their intention to see
domestic animals that stand higher than 4 inches or longer than six
clothed at all times, though fish and fowl were excluded.
Oh, our purpose in clothing animals is strictly for the sake of decency. In other words, we feel that there's an inconsistency in our culture that human beings should wear clothing and animals don't. In other words, we're members of the animal kingdom. Does that make sense to you?
He told the hosts of these shows that Cinna already had over 50,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and Great Britain, and that it was growing every day as more and more of the population woke up to what he believed to be an imminent threat to our children's precarious innocence. He said that members of Cinna agreed to volunteer on behalf of the organization by handing out Cinna summonses to people in the suburbs, the cities, and the country who were in possession of naked animals, whether they be pets or livestock. At times it was suggested, complete with props, that a kangaroo could wear a pair of pantaloons, a deer could wear an altered burlap sack, and a cow could wear a moo-moo. Prout actually told media outlets, quote,
"Well, I think every horse should wear Bermuda shorts and every cow a half slip."
Cinna believed that the sight of naked animals
triggers moral deterioration and helps explain why there is so much juvenile delinquency and adult crime.
They provided the members with different kinds of outfits for different kinds of animals, so they were always ready to jump into action.
Now, this unusual device here is called a Cinna Clothmobile, a vehicle, a truck that we send into small communities with a driver and a Cinna member who can spot a naked animal at 50 feet.
The vice president of Cinna, Bruce Spencer, a serious man with prominent eyebrows, often seen smoking a pipe or cigar, was known to make public appearances on behalf of Cinna, and together, the men appeared on every major American newscast during the early 1960s, facing off with both a confused Barbara Walters and a smirking Johnny Carson. The nationally syndicated Mike Douglas show even saw Spencer sparring over animal clothing with famous starlets Gypsy Rose Lee and Jane Mansfield. Often during these appearances, Spencer would sing their marching song called The Wings of Decency.
High on the wings of Cinna, we fight for the future now. Let's clothe every pet and animal, whether dog, cat, horse, or cow. S-I-N-A, that's our call, all for one and one for all. Hoist our flag for all to see, waving for morality.
Letters from the public were overflowing the New York headquarters of Cinna. Some invited Prout and Spencer to speak at their churches and schools, and a wealthy philanthropist even sent Cinna a $40,000 check. That's around $350,000 today, which they turned down as their bylaws prevented donations. But many others were downright outraged and sent expletive-filled tirades to their mailing address.
Dear lame brain, if I was the president, I would shoot your ass off. Whoever was so dumb as to start that crap of animals wearing pants, boy, even back in Jesus Christ's time here on Earth, he never said, clothe the animals. So if he didn't think it was indecent, why does a bunch of nuts like you try something like this? Get gone, you goddamn nuts. What the hell are you, communists or some crazy cult? Signed, Unsigned.
In addition to ironically being labeled perverts, they received at least one serious death threat after Spencer went on the Les Crane show and required a police escort home because someone had called in and said they were going to shoot him when he left the studio. The San Francisco Chronicle elected to print a week-long front-page series on the organization. The reporter took Prout and Spencer to the city zoo, requesting that the pair show him the actual mechanics of clothing several different kinds of animals, which they were able to do with only a little trouble. The headline of these articles,
SINA claims that animal nudity in San Francisco is sinful.
And
the zoo is a peep show for children.
The Society for Indecency to Naked Animals began their political work in earnest by picketing the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the National Better Business Bureau, the Federal Trade Commission, the Public Utilities Commission, and the U.S. Attorney General's Office, claiming that they had not done enough to stop this public menace, accusing some of actively encouraging the perversion.
We have lobbyists in Congress right now. We have two people in Washington who are passing out leaflets among senators and representatives, writing them letters, calling them on the phone. And at least once a week, Mr. Prout puts in a long-distance call to President Kennedy.
They protested appearances by J. Edgar Hoover and Robert Kennedy and organized their biggest event right outside the White House. In March of 1963, members showed up to plead for new federal legislation that would outlaw nudity in animals. Claiming that hundreds would flock to the protest, in the end, it was only three of the key players of SINA, including Bruce Spencer and his wife. To explain why the masses didn't appear for the demonstration, Spencer told the media that they had been rained out, even though this rain was just a very light drizzle. But lucky for SINA, a large crowd did form to watch the spectacle, as did many major news outlets, as Spencer's wife held up a sign that appealed directly to the First Lady and First Daughter. A nude horse is a rude horse. Mrs. Kennedy, won't you please clothe Caroline's horse? SINA was really the invention of Prout Jr.'s father, the late G. Clifford Prout Sr., who was inspired by his father, Otis, a Civil War soldier in his youth, who instead of declaring allegiance, actually claimed to have fought against both the North and the South, donning blue pants and a gray jacket. And legend has it that when he met General Grant, he slapped him across the face for being drunk during the Battle of Gettysburg. According to the organization, the impetus for SINA was actually born on the battlefields, where Otis Prout struggled with horses, delaying battles as he tried to slip them into specifically tailored shorts. Prout Jr. said his grandfather had a very special relationship with animals and that he spent his life trying to learn their languages, hoping for real communication. Following in his footsteps, Prout Sr. had left a massive inheritance of almost $500,000 to his son, with the request that he use the money to carry on this familial crusade. When people questioned the confusing phrasing of the acronym of SINA, which again stood for the Society for Indecency to Naked Animals, implying that they were actually for the indecency, they explained that the name was a direct result of Prout Sr.'s will, which said that everything must be done exactly as indicated. In the summer of 1962, SINA made it to the biggest of the big time, CBS News Live with Walter Cronkite, then known as the most trusted man in America. But after the live interview ended and the SINA people left the studio, some CBS employees came up to Cronkite with some disturbing information. They had recognized this man named G. Clifford Prout Jr. as their former coworker, a writer and comedian named Buck Henry. That's when Walter Cronkite and the rest of CBS knew that they had been totally bamboozled. The Society for Indecency to Naked Animals was an elaborate, 4-year-long hoax. April Fools, you beautiful fools. Dear listeners, did I get you? The idea for this massive prank was sparked by Alan Abel, a.k.a. Senna Vice President Bruce Spencer, when he was stuck in traffic on a rural highway because a bull and a cow were mating quite graphically in the middle of the road. Alan began to observe the traffic scene. Two salesmen were doubled over laughing. Two nuns hid their faces from the vulgar sight. And a woman looked on in a kind of disapproving rage. Alan found this all very funny, very peculiar, that people would so easily forget that, as he put it, the whole world is the bedroom of the animal, and that they can't comprehend the nuances of modern human morality. And so, Alan asked his friend, actor and writer Buck Henry, to pose as Cinna's president, a man who would go on to co-write the 1967 Oscar-nominated screenplay for The Graduate, to co-create the show Get Smart with Mel Brooks, and become a 5-time host of Saturday Night Live. The Madison Avenue office, where so many angry letters had been sent, was actually nothing more than a broom closet rented by Alan for $5 a month, with a placard announcing that it was Cinna's headquarters. His friend George Wayne provided Cinna's iconic artwork, mainly a horse in Bermuda shorts, and his wife Jean was his partner in crime, that very woman holding the sign addressing Jackie Kennedy, her daughter, and their naked horse. Alan Abel later explained that there was a deeper meaning behind this absurdist hoax, to mock the censorship of banned books and other media, and the accompanying moral outrage around this melodramatic phenomenon called indecency. I think it's fair to say that our subject today was the most prolific media hoaxer in American history. And for this episode, we are looking at the decades-long career of a man who lived his life as performance art, making a never-ending commentary on politics, culture, and the media, as well as the unlimited gullibility of everyday Americans. That's right after this. You ever notice how finding time and energy to do the most basic human necessity, eat literal food, has become just another exhausting task jammed into our increasingly inhuman schedules? Well, your spring can be a little more stress-free with Factor. Factor will provide you with delicious, never frozen, ready to eat gourmet meals that are chef crafted, dietitian approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Each week, you get to choose from a menu of 35 options to create your perfect breakfast, lunch, or dinner with absolutely no prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. And Factor makes sure you get exactly what you want. You can tailor deliveries to your schedule and customize how many meals you want each and every week, and you can pause anytime. So just head to factormeals.com/AmericanHysteria50 and use code AmericanHysteria50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code AmericanHysteria50 at factormeals.com/AmericanHysteria50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Check out Factor today. And now, back to the show. That little scamp, Alan Abel, was born on August 2nd, 1924, to a Jewish family in Ohio, eventually moving out to study music at the State University. On one particular college day, he was asked to address the incoming freshmen. And as he crossed the stage, he tripped and somersaulted right into the orchestra pit. When he heard the roars of laughter from the crowd, something inside him aligned, and he knew that he wanted to be a performer. He switched to studying jazz percussion and graduated in 1950, winning major drum awards and playing with big bands and in jazz clubs, as well as doing stand-up comedy on the side. When neither path panned out the way he wanted, he decided to launch a career as a very different kind of performance artist. In the summer of 1958, just a year before he founded Cinna, Allen had, like millions of other Americans, watched Elvis Presley make history on the Ed Sullivan Show. He witnessed what he called the Elvis Presley effect, as a legion of Elvis copycats were unleashed with far less talent and far less star quality. Record execs, eager to find the next big thing, were throwing money at anything cute and young that could make anything that sounded like rock and roll. And standing out among the others meant finding a gimmick. Allen came up with a larger-than-life character named Count von Blitzstein, who possessed an irresistible aristocratic flair and old-world charm, and sent out a long and detailed press release to 25 of the most successful record companies of the time.
Count von Blitzstein, international playboy, skier, and singer par excellence, has arrived in the United States from Switzerland to pursue a singing career. The Count, born at Juska Bosnia-Herzegovina, distinguished himself during World War II by single-handedly capturing a battalion of Bessarabians in the Carpathian Mountains. No stranger to cloak-and-dagger methods, the Count experienced one spine-chilling escapade after another, finally leading a lone guerrilla movement in the Antarctic until he was wounded by a stalagmite.
It took only 48 hours for RCA, Columbia, MGM, Capitol, and many other smaller companies to request samples of the Count's songs. Allen got to work creating a fake live recording by overlaying the sounds of a nightclub audience with his terrible singing, along with audio from his friend George playing a French waiter begging him to stop.
"Please think of the customers eating their food. I beg of you, monsieur, fermez la bouche."
Allen's wife, Jean Abel, would later say of Allen's character, quote, "If Frankenstein's monster could play and sing the piano, he'd be doing an imitation of you." It's become incredibly obscure, but you better believe we found a dusty old copy on eBay and converted it just for you.
Your eyes,
monsieur.
Monsieur, I must ask you to stop playing at once. The customers are complaining.
Forgetful of our promise of love, you're sharing another's charm.
Monsieur, please, come back later, after they have eaten.
The sad lament, my dreams have faded like a broken melody.
Monsieur, please, I beg of you, please stop playing.
While the gods of love look down and laugh.
The album would be recognized eventually as more comedy than sincerity, and after its release, Allen would net a whopping 18 cents.
"There'll be a change, there'll be a change, there'll be a change in government. One year that gets to be first lady and loss of the president."
leading up to the relatively vicious 1964 election between Lyndon Johnson and Barry Goldwater, Alan Abel and his lifelong pranking partner Gene injected some levity into the political atmosphere, creating a fictitious candidate, a Jewish housewife from the Bronx. Yetta Bronstein was leading a new political party called the Best Party with the campaign slogan,
"Vote for Yetta and things will get better."
She said America was desperately in need of a mother. Her platforms included things like a national bingo tournament to determine tax rates, mink coats for all, and free bagels for everyone. She floated the idea of putting a nude photograph of Jane Fonda on postal stamps to help with the national deficit, while at the same time helping those unfortunate souls too destitute to afford a Playboy magazine. Yetta advocated for a more efficient Congress by means of switching their pay from salaries to commission, putting a truth serum in the Senate's drinking fountains, and installing a mental detector that members of Congress had to pass through to get to the floor. Honestly, at this point, she has my vote. Since Yetta was not real, they always had to have an excuse to keep her out of the public eye, using a photograph of Alan's mother for her campaign posters and using Jean's Yiddish accent for hundreds of telephone and radio interviews. To give Yetta even more personality while lacking an actual person to parade around, she recorded contemporary pop songs as part of her platform to attract younger voters.
Oh yeah, I'll tell you something. I think you'll understand. Then I'll say this something. I want to hold your hand. I want to hold your hand.
Yetta ran again in 1968 and 1972, and at one point even received a signed photo inscribed "To Yetta" from her competitor, Richard Nixon. Despite losing the federal elections, the Abels ran Yetta as a candidate for the mayor of New York City and also for parliament in the UK. And of course, none of these campaigns got very far, but Yetta continued to be a source of media fascination even after the hoax had been revealed.
Live from the Sex Bowl, welcome to the International Sex Games. This is Raven Armsmith speaking to you live from the Sex Bowl.
Just as the sexual revolution was kicking off in the summer of 1971, the news both at home and abroad reported on the first International Sex Bowl. The event was funded by a secret group of anonymous West Coast business elites who pooled $200,000 to create a classy black tie event in the style of the Olympic Games. The contest was advertised as the most shocking sporting event ever to be staged, and the press release sent out to all the major networks and newspapers read,
"Seven talented couples, all amateurs, representing the United States, Russia, France, Italy, West Germany, Red China, and South Africa will compete during four rounds of sexual activity.
Judged by their
gracefulness, grossness, potency, and mutual respect."
The contest was to be shown in a closed-circuit telecast on Monday, June 7th, from a private location in New York City. Harriet Van Horn, writing for the San Francisco Examiner, took the Sex Bowl quite seriously, writing, quote, "The new liberation has given license to the sexual psychotics, the sadomasochists, the depraved, the voyeurs." the event was picketed by activist group SOS, or Stamp Out Smut, a handful of anti-pornography activists who marched outside the alleged location, carrying angry signs and demanding that the show must not go on. However, and I saw this one coming, the protesters were hired by Allen himself in an attempt to draw more attention to a movie that he and Gene had been producing, a hilarious and extremely risque full-length mockumentary called Is There Sex After Death? They had also planted stories in the international press about a new topless string quartet that turned out to be more promotion for their movie, appearing one time only as they performed a song called Breast Rock in the mockumentary.
Now that we have reached the last holdout of human ignorance, the nature of man's sexuality in America today, I'd like to invite you inside these doors.
The film is built around the Bureau of Sexological Investigation's sex expert, Dr. Harrison Rogers, Alan Abel, as he travels the country looking into offbeat sexual practices of interesting subjects. The Bureau travels to a nudist camp in Florida and discusses the merits of group sex. An uncanny Richard Nixon impersonator discusses his sexual experiences in the White House. Merkin, the X-rated magician, shows his risque tricks to the camera. There's an interview with famous trans actress Holly Woodlawn.
Do you think that the armed services discriminate against transsexuals?
Thank God they do, otherwise I'd be fighting in Vietnam.
Buck Henry, former faux president of CINA, played Dr. Manos, an instructor of breast development.
What I'm saying to you, America, is it doesn't matter how large a breast of a woman's is, as long as they're huge.
And Jim Morin played Dr. Elevenike, the author of The Orifice Precipice.
The male organ has an average of 6 inches in length. The female orifice has 8 inches of possibility, which means that if you translate this to world population, there are some millions of miles of unused orifice.
The only non-satirical part of the movie are the many real on-the-street interviews with willing strangers.
What is the ideal penis length?
Just about 4 or 5 inches, just about like that.
Oh, about 9.5.
Down here.
Right about
below the knee.
The movie has fallen into almost complete obscurity, but if you look hard enough, you can find it. The next year, Alan pretended for the first time to be a real living person instead of a character that he invented. The fabulously rich and intriguingly reclusive eccentric Howard Hughes was a man who rarely made any public appearances, and any sighting of him was an automatic media goldmine. After calling a press conference, major news outlets showed up to the St. Regis Hotel in New York City. But what they saw was a man pushed out in a wheelchair, cartoonish bandages covering his entire head with just 2 slits for eyes and a slit for his mouth. As the reporters gathered around, I imagine trading glances and shrugging their shoulders, they held their microphones toward the mummified face. That's when Howard made his announcement that he was planning to be cryogenically frozen and then thawed out when the stock market was at its peak. After answering a handful of questions, he was wheeled out as quickly as he came. And a few days later, reporters aggressively requested a second press conference. And here is how it all unfolded.
After a week of strenuous investigation on the part of Channel 5, we've got you back in our studios. Well, now, our investigation has shown, sir, that you indeed are not the real Howard Hughes. Is that correct?
Why don't we just remove the bandages? My doctor's here.
Doctor, please, Dr. Schwartz, the bandages.
Take off the bandages. It's the only way. It's premature.
This is Dr. Donald Schwartz.
If
also there on Monday.
If you can't accept me in good faith for what I claim and who I am, then we'll just remove the bandages. There's no other way in which to prove.
That is not Howard Hughes's nose.
When was the last time you saw Howard?
The last time I saw Howard Hughes, he had a brilliant blue nose.
Well, you didn't see the right Howard Hughes then. There must be a lot of them around.
I don't think I'm seeing the right Howard Hughes right now, sir.
Well, how do I know who you are?
Well, that's not the point.
Of course it's a point. Prove to me who you are. I mean, this is ridiculous, isn't it?
Well, Mr. Hughes, real Mr. Howard Hughes, please stand up.
This is ridiculous.
Unmasked.
Wow.
Now, do you still say that you're Howard Hughes?
Well, I don't think I'd better at this point.
I think that I remember you as the man who, at one time, had everyone putting pants on dogs.
Yes. As a matter of fact, I recommended that every animal should be clothed, namely horses, cows, dogs, cats, any...
And I remember a time when you were promoting something called the International Sex Bowl, which never existed.
Well, the idea was good. Couples copulating from around the world for...
Keep it clean, Mr. Hughes. I'm sorry, Mr. Your name?
Right out of Webster's.
What is your name?
Well, I've traveled in various things. I've been Count von Blitzstein when I sing. I've been Dr. Bruce Spencer when I've measured the big toe and proved that it's growing at the rate of 1/100 of an inch a year.
But beneath all of the aliases, you are known to your close friends, both of them as...
Is that a cue?
Yes.
Oh, well, most people call me Alan Abel.
Alan Abel.
But presently I'm Dr. Harrison T. Rogers.
So you are now admitting that Alan Abel put on the entire city of New York and the news media.
Yes.
Did you think that was funny, Mr. Abel?
Yeah, I did.
What you hear next is one of those reporters pieing Alan in the face.
I thought it was a...
A couple years later, pretending to be a former White House staffer, Alan called a press conference claiming to have secretly obtained the 18.5-minute gap that was missing from the explosive Watergate tapes. When he pressed the button on the tape player, he feigned shock that his bombshell recording had been mysteriously erased. Not long after that, he hired an actor who appeared in front of the many cameras and microphones at a press conference at the Hilton Hotel in New York City and told reporters that he was the famous anonymous Watergate informant known as Deep Throat. He began to tell them how he fed secret information to journalists Woodward and Bernstein when he fainted, ending the event. Both of these pranks were just more promo for his second mockumentary, The Faking of the President, which used cut-ups of different interviews and speeches by Richard Nixon to tell a totally different story of his time in the Oval Office. More after this. And now, back to the show. In 1975, Alan debuted what would become his longest-running prank, assuming the character of Omar Rockford, or Omar the Panhandler, a working-class man down on his luck who turned to panhandling to support his wife and infant child. To the press, Omar recounted how, in a state of depression, he realized that his life insurance policy was the one thing of value that he still had, and he decided to step into heavy New York traffic. But he was suddenly stopped by an older man in a three-piece suit who gave him a $20 bill and reassured him that it would all be okay. This gave Omar his brilliant idea. If he was able to get $20 from this man out of sympathy alone, why not turn ordinary panhandling into an art form? And why should it just be for the desperately destitute? At a time when thousands of New Yorkers were working night and day just to make ends meet, panhandling, done right, might prove to be a lucrative business. So he opened the fictional Omar's School for Beggars, a $100 one-week course where students learned that, quote,
"You've got to have an emergency, a ploy, a gimmick. You're only going to get the money if it's an emergency. You don't have time to tell them the story of your life."
And what, you might ask, does the School for Beggars teach?
What we do is we take you and we instruct you on how to beg. It's very simple, because you only have 15 seconds in front of that mark, just 15 seconds. And you have to zero right in there. You have to tell them your story. You have to show sincerity, and you have to get that buck. Because if you don't do it in 15 seconds, you're not going to get it in an hour.
For $100, he says he can teach anyone to beg successfully.
I think we are accomplishing something for today's society. We're keeping people off welfare rolls, off unemployment lines, and we've got them out there making a living.
After taking the course, Omar claimed that some of his students were able to get $400 to $500 a week through begging alone, helping them to get back on their feet. He even wrote a book full of his wisdom called The Panhandler's Handbook. As always, Allen made a large number of television appearances as Omar over the course of more than a decade, usually with a cloth hood over his face to mask his identity. In interviews as Omar, he is serious when talking about the struggles of the working class.
"These are the forgotten people, and there are literally hundreds of thousands. How do they survive? They rob Peter to pay Paul. They live on credit cards. Maybe they get unemployment insurance and they work off the books. They get along by their wits, and they're very unhappy."
Interestingly, the hoax was debunked very quickly back in 1975, but reporters continued to take the bait all the way until 1988, and papers, including New York Magazine, the Miami Herald, and the BBC, did stories on his School for Beggars. The idea that people who were panhandling were really con men proved an attractive story throughout the 1980s, when poor people were continuously demonized and criminalized by the Reagan administration. One day, in 1985, the king of daytime talk, Phil Donahue, was taping an episode at Rockefeller Center, having just moved his show from Chicago only weeks before. Donahue, whose program aired live in certain time zones, was interviewing a woman from the audience on the subject of gay senior citizens when she began to sway and eventually full-on faint right in front of the camera, with Donahue attempting to break her fall.
Yes, ma'am? And?
I'm feeling a little...
Well, I know. I felt that way. Hold on just a moment. We'll be back in just a moment.
When the cameras began rolling again and medics removed her from the studio, Donahue attempted to soldier on, but eventually had to stop taping entirely as more people began fainting.
Our viewers are entitled to know that we've lost another one.
Donahue then decided to take the precaution of clearing out the studio audience, filming the remainder of his show with only himself, his panelists, and the production crew present in the studio.
It was live television with a fastly fading studio audience for the Phil Donahue Show today.
Combination of the lights, the possible anxiety of the live television, and the heat caused one woman to faint. And then four others fainted.
It took Alan Abel more than a week to finally explain what had really happened, calling a press conference to admit the hoax, at least in part. He claimed the whole thing was masterminded by yet another fictitious organization, this one called FAINT, or Fight Against Idiotic Neurotic Television. The organization's goal? To protest the declining quality of American TV. Quote, "We want to raise the consciousness of the public by going unconscious." Alan later expressed some regret over what he had done to Phil Donahue, but it all worked out in the end. He told a reporter, quote,
"His producer told me he kicked the furniture in his office. He was so upset. It really threw him out of control. Then his ratings went up and he was very pleased. Phil sent me a Christmas card that said, 'Hope nothing causes you to feel faint in the next year.'"
Alan pivoted in 1991 and sent out a fax to 12,000 members of New York's American Federation of Musicians, introducing a new curiosity, a new revolution in classical music, the official Ku Klux Klan Symphony Orchestra. The flyer announced that the group was
coming soon to your community,
and that it would rival the New York Philharmonic, that it would be
the first giant step in changing the image of the Ku Klux Klan.
The flyer continued,
"We're trying to do it through music, a language that shows no barriers. This is going to be quite a dramatic thrust into the cultural arena."
Apparently, they offered health insurance, travel expenses, and a whopping $1,500 a week to the players, which was double what was offered for other prestigious symphony positions. They claimed they were now an equal opportunity employer, allowing blacks and Jews, as well as all other racial and ethnic groups, as long as they were willing to wear hoods to hide their identity. They claimed that it was the former Grand Wizard of the KKK himself, David Duke, who had come up with the idea, as he, in reality, was trying to present a more clean-cut image of white Christian supremacy to go with his thrust into the political arena as he ran for governor of Louisiana.
When Duke left the Klan, he founded the National Association for the Advancement of White People.
This is not the issue of this campaign. It's not a Jewish Christian issue or controversy. It's not a black-white controversy. I'm an individual standing up for equal rights for everybody.
When news outlets reached out for comment about his new KKK Symphony Orchestra, David Duke replied quite wholesomely, "That's the biggest bunch of granola I ever heard." According to an interview in which Alan revealed the hoax, he told the journalist that he had wanted to humiliate the KKK and make people think twice about taking the organization seriously, telling the reporter, quote, "The KKK is laughable." From the mid-80s to the mid-90s, Alan and Gene continued their creative commentaries and continued to fool news, radio, and TV talk shows.
He is here to talk about a program that he has gotten started that grew out of his own experiences in the prison. It's called Females for Felons. And this is the man who's behind it wearing a mask today because he is in the Federal Witness Protection Program. Good morning. Thanks for coming.
My pleasure of being here. I felt while being incarcerated, you're given a certain amount of food. Your punishment is you've given up your freedom. In prisons, we've got literally thousands of good guys who realize their mistake, like I realized mine. Yeah. I paid for it. Mm-hmm. I paid for it. But why should I be denied the one area that could truly be a reward and uplifting?
What do you think, Fred?
It's a very interesting presentation.
A man so desperate, so in need of money, that he's putting his body parts up for sale. Barry Cunningham with this story.
He says he's a victim of the recession, so deeply in debt that the only way out is to sell off his body part, organ by organ, to the highest bidder.
Well, it's just pretty much the only thing I have of value that's worth, anything to sell.
Before you tell us what happened, it is daytime television. Don't take us off the air, okay? Give us the daytime version of what happened.
So I waited till I was sure he was asleep. I grabbed my trusty little tube of Crazy Glue. I kind of pulled back the sheets gently. And I glued his penis to his butt, right where it belongs.
In the angriest moments that I've had with this woman, I would never think of gluing her parts together.
He was back at it again in 1993 when pathologist Jack Kevorkian's work around physician-assisted suicide for terminal patients became the biggest debate topic in the news. Allen created another company in Florida called Euthanasia Cruises that offered 3 days of pure partying on a luxury ship before allowing their customers to jump into the ocean.
He said, I think Donald Trump is an artful liar. I think he is a greedy, vicious, and arrogant man.
Well, I don't know, is that supposed to be a compliment or not? I'm not sure.
In 1994, Allen stood outside Donald Trump's Fifth Avenue, New York office, selling copies of one of his spoof books, How to Thrive on Rejection. He was notified by Trump's team that he was on private property and forced off the public sidewalk. He actually took Trump to Manhattan's small claims court and won a lawsuit against him, with the judge conceding that he had violated the civil rights of Allen Abel and caused a restraint of trade, awarding him damages in the amount of $919.58. When Allen, shockingly, did not receive the money from Trump, he attempted, unsuccessfully, to put a lien on his estate, Mar-a-Lago. Allen, of course, would never see so much as a cent from Donald Trump. In 1999, Allen actually snuck himself into HBO's unprecedented special featuring interviews with naked men called Private Dicks, Men Exposed. He claimed to hold the record for the world's smallest penis, though when it came time to disrobe, he refused, still making it somehow into the final cut.
When having sex, I think the penis is the punctuation. It's the exclamation point. It's the last hurrah. It's the victory flag. Rockets go off, Roman candles, stars and stripes is in the background. That's what the penis is all about.
And then, commenting on the continued conservatism and censorship of the Bush administration, Allen created Citizens Against Breastfeeding, staging fake protests at the Republican National Convention and going on hundreds of radio, news, and talk shows. He had yet another new character, the president of the organization, Jim Rogers, who called breastfeeding an erotic and incestuous act between mother and son that should be made illegal as it was causing kids to turn to smoking, drinking, and to become antisocial, stating that the naughty nipple was the source of most juvenile bad behavior.
Should women be allowed to breastfeed in public? One of our guests tonight says absolutely not. Jim Rogers is the East Coast spokesman for Citizens Against Breastfeeding. And Leslie Burby is the vice president of ProMom. So, Jim, let's start with you. What's wrong with breastfeeding in the open? Is it too sexy?
Many youngsters grow up to become, shall we say, antisocial because of the long breastfeeding period when they are addicted.
Leslie, do you have any reaction to what Jim is saying?
Well, with due respect, had I known that Jim was going to be on the show, I don't know that I would have agreed to appear.
In 2007, the post-9/11 terror alert system called the Homeland Security Color Code that was used on the news to tell citizens how likely a terrorist attack was that day became Allen's next satirical target.
Since March 2002, the five-colored palette has attempted to guide Americans on the likelihood of a terror attack, from low-risk green to severe-risk red. The problem is, too many have found it meaningless.
It's not really clear, you know, what orange is versus yellow.
It's always, what, orange elevated?
Well, I don't think anybody really pays attention to it anyways.
He created the organization Concerned Colorblind Citizens and stood outside the White House protesting the use of this discriminatory code. He claimed he actually witnessed Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice reading one of their flyers while leaning against the security fence and laughing. Though whether we should trust Allen's word on that, I really can't say. In 2009, Allen returned to his CINNA roots, creating a campaign that is perhaps my personal favorite, Stop Bird Porn. Along with his friend, Lena Potapova, who posed as a serious activist named Anita Kroc of the Good Conduct Society, Allen created a blog that drew millions of hits that labeled bird watchers as voyeuristic perverts.
Where are you from?
Edina, Minnesota.
And why are you here?
We're here for the animals. We represent an organization called Stop Bird Porn. It's on the web, stopbirdporn.org. It's an issue that's all about the privacy of animals and respecting them in nature and not being a voyeur and watching
predators.
Them when they're mating, exactly. And we feel it's protecting children, making sure that they don't see inappropriate things in nature. And there's many statistics that'll show that once you start watching animal mating behavior, it can lead to other deviant things. And so we really want to nip that in the bud. We feel if the Geo Party is supposedly the family value party that they espouse to be, that they would look at this issue and seriously restrict probably the sale of binoculars. Certainly, there needs to be restrictions. I mean, that's what we're hoping.
Protesting both the Republican National Convention and the Denver appearances by Democratic frontrunner Barack Obama, Allen drew so many reporters to the cause that a line formed, and apparently more people flocked to the Stop Bird Porn people than to the future president. After each press appearance, hundreds or thousands of people would flock to their page, stopbirdporn.com, to determine for themselves how serious of a movement this really was. A version of the website is still up today at stopbirdporn.wordpress.com. One of Allen's most successful and well-known press bamboozles came in 1980 when he succeeded in convincing the New York Times that he was dead. When the paper followed up on the infamous hoaxer to make sure this wasn't a macabre prank, Allen was ready. He went into hiding for weeks. He set up a fake business with a real phone number that the media could call to get in touch with the undertaker who handled his body, played, of course, by either Allen himself or a friend in cahoots. He went as far as to put a down payment on his own wake. He hired a woman to play his grieving widow, who delivered the message to the Times while crying her eyes out. It took a full 12 friends to help Allen complete his own death, which he called, punnily, a tremendous undertaking. After their fact-checking was finished, the New York Times ran a full obituary for the underground avant-garde con artist, who they said had died of a heart attack while skiing in Utah as he was scouting a location for a new horror movie he was directing called Who's Going to Bite Your Neck, Dear, When All of My Teeth Are Gone? He was thrilled that the sometimes pompously prestigious institution known as the New York Times had to make a full retraction of his death announcement. When he died for real, a whole 38 years later, newspapers around the nation worked a whole lot harder to make sure this one was legit, with the New York Times headline reading, "Alan Abel, hoaxer extraordinaire, is, on good authority, dead at 94. In her fantastic 2005 documentary, Abel Raises Cain, made with her partner Jeff Hockett, Alan and Jean's daughter Jenny recounts her parents' career as media hoaxers and gives a behind-the-scenes look at their very modest lifestyle. In it, Alan is always chewing on or waving around a half-smoked cigar, usually unlit, as he talks about his life, sitting at the table and writing furiously every day in a small house that would eventually be lost to creditors. According to Jenny, he did receive some funding from wealthy but mysterious fans, who she said, quote, lived vicariously through his hoaxing. And he did get paid here and there for media appearances and public talks. But Alan struggled financially his whole life, refusing to accept donations to his fake foundations. For Alan, his work simply wasn't about the money. In his 1970 autobiography that cataloged his hoaxes up until that point, Alan gave some of his philosophy behind his life's work. Quote, "A put-on is not necessarily a put-down. I liken what I do sometimes to a life game, an adventure in absurdity, an adult fairy tale in which I engage people emotionally and intellectually. The audience gets involved and has to decide for itself what's going on and what's to be learned from the experience. Everybody is a participant. I like to think people will learn something from my hijinks, that they will become a little more cautious before accepting and believing everything they read or hear or see." Fooling all those media outlets meant a lot to Alan, and it was a part of a greater point he wanted to make, that major newspapers and networks often failed at their own journalistic standards in ways far more dire than a merry prankster faking his death. On this April Fool's Day, I want to honor the holiness of the absurdist hoax, the power of holding a carnival mirror up to society and letting us all see the absurdity of the culture that we've created, the culture that has been created for us, and the often ridiculous outrage that fuels it all. But at the same time, we have to acknowledge its darker potential when hoaxes become sensational propaganda in the hands of the powerful rather than in the hands of the people. Because, as Alan said, the next time around, their hoaxer might truly be diabolical and rob them of things far more important and meaningful. Happy April Fool's Day, dear listeners, and rest in peace, Alan Abel. May you now be the official court jester in the kingdom of the dead. And through your lifetime of hoaxes, may we all see ourselves, finally, gullible and humbled for the suckers we really are. This was American Hysteria. If you want to get more of our show, you can head to patreon.com/American Hysteria or subscribe on Apple Plus. You'll get ad-free episodes as well as bonus content, like our other podcast, Hysteria Home Companion, where producer Miranda and I tell you stories that were left out of the episodes or tell you stories that we think that you would love. So if you'd like to get a behind-the-scenes look and support our show, that's patreon.com/American Hysteria or subscribe on Apple Plus. You can also join us on Instagram at American Hysteria Podcast. If you head to AmericanHysteria.com, you can pick up some of our merch and leave us a message on our Urban Legends hotline about a story that you remember hearing growing up, and we might just do an entire episode about it. American Hysteria is written, produced, and hosted by me, Chelsea Weber Smith. Our producer and editor is Miranda Zickler, and our sound designer and associate producer is Riley Swedelius Smith. Thanks, as always, for listening. And if I didn't April Fool's you today, well, I hope someone did. Have a great week.